One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories. We create connections between your ears and minds and our guests' songs, memories, and stories. We tap into music's power to viscerally link us to times in our lives in order to bring out the storyteller in us all. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. My guest today is Jeff McCullers. He's not just fifth generation Florida. He's fifth generation Estero, which means he must at least be part Koreshian. I'm mostly kid, or is that even possible? Jeff grew up around citrus farming, fishing, construction, and well drilling. I love the fact that his three-sentence bio includes his 10 years as a 4-H club member. He says he wrote two small books on local history while in high school. He's been with the Lee County School District for 34 years as a teacher and administrator. Over the years, he taught English, drama, journalism, stagecraft, and humanities. He's also an amateur poet, photographer, and painter, all three of which he kicks ass at, I'm sure. Well, I've known Jeff mostly via Facebook for the past decade or so. I knew him by reputation all the way back to my high school years in the late 80s. You see, at the time, Cypress Lake High was starting to get quite the reputation for its theater productions, musical theater in particular. And while I never knew quite where Jeff fit into that scene at the time, all of my friends who were doing theater there spoke of him, he taught at Cypress, like he was a living legend. And years later, now that I've got to know him, they were certainly not joking. As a matter of fact, I believe I've looked forward to this episode with him more than any of these yet, so let's get right to it. Hey there, Jeff McCullers.
Well, hello there, Mike Canary. What an intro.
Oh, hey, you know, it was easy to write. It's, you know, it's easy when it's true, right? Was Estero even a thing five generations ago? Like, when did the name Estero become attached to the geographic region that is Estero?
It's been Estero for a pretty long time.
Okay.
As long as anybody I ever knew could remember. Estero Bay was Estero Bay. The little town of Estero was only known by the very few people that actually lived there.
So I joked sort of about the Koreshians in the intro. Is there any intersection between your family and that story? Since you're five generations, if I do the math correctly, there would have been some at least contemporariness.
Oh, sure.
Right?
I had some cousins who were members, and I had other cousins who worked for the Koreshian Unity later on, even in my lifetime.
So for our listeners who may not be from this area, what's like the three-sentence version of Koreshians?
The Koreshians were a charismatic sect that moved here from Chicago in the late 1880s or so and settled here on the Estero River and wanted to build a city of 6 million people, a kind of utopia.
They wanted to build Cape Coral before it was
– Well, they gave it a good try too.
You know, I actually have a bit of overlap with the Koreshians. You know, Gwen's mom, Sam, owned a house in Fort Myers near Allen Park Elementary that we found out by doing some record search that the builder and original owner of the house was the person who edited The Flaming Sword, which was the Koreshian publication.
I have a few of those in my house.
Oh, really?
Yes, I do.
Oh, wow. That does not surprise me. Okay. So what was the musical background of your childhood?
Well, my childhood, I learned some songs from my mother. She liked to sing gospel songs and country songs, a few rock and roll songs. She was a Buddy Holly fan. My dad was not much of a singer, but he liked to sing a couple of Chuck Berry songs to annoy me. And that he had a lot of fun doing that and occasionally still does. We listened to the local country station mostly. That was what was in the house when I was very young.
Was there any record playing going on?
Yes. We always had a record player as kids. It was one of the toys we always had. We got children's records. We would get, you know, different things for Christmas and so on. Didn't occur to me though until I started going to school that there might be music I wanted to pursue myself. It just wasn't really an interest or something I even thought about until I started hearing music on the school bus later on. And then the adventure started.
Was there any musical instruments being played by yourself or anybody in your family around you?
Not by me, unfortunately. My brother was a musician.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And both his kids are, but both my children are, but I didn't actually get that bug.
Okay. So you never have
I never
been
played.
Okay. No. Do you sing?
I sing all the time.
Oh, yeah?
Just not for other people.
Okay. Well, that's one of my questions. I was going to get to later, but we're going to jump right to it. So what's your favorite song to sing? And parse this out between whether there is someone present or not. Or will you just not sing if there's someone present?
I'm just too self-conscious to sing. But I do sing a lot of Willie Nelson, a lot of Elvis Costello, a lot of roots reggae. It's quite a mix.
So you probably don't do karaoke then?
I have never done karaoke. I've never even seen people do karaoke.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Huh.
It's too risky.
What? You might get sucked in.
You might get sucked in, right.
Okay. What is the earliest musical memory that you can recall if you just dig back and see what flashes?
The earliest musical memory, it's got to be church, you know, singing in church. They meant well, but they were not – singing was not their forte really. So they would even take the happier songs and give them kind of a dreary dirge quality.
What church would this have
been? This was the Astoria United Methodist Church. Lovely people and beautiful songs. They just needed a little zip sometimes, but they were very welcoming of me.
But so that would be the earliest that you can think of.
That's the earliest.
And you probably
weren't
in the choir then either, were you?
I was not in the choir, no.
Can you remember the first time that music moved you emotionally?
I can remember the first time that I heard the musical Jesus Christ Superstar. I was staying in a friend's house in Fort Myers, and this was – you know, right when it came out. So it's like 70, 71, I guess. I'm 9 years old maybe. And he wanted to listen to it. So his mom put it on the big, you know, the big massive console they had in those days. It was a piece of furniture the size of the living room. And we put it on. We listened to all four sides from beginning to end. And I was knocked out that a story that precise and that moving could be told through song. I'd never experienced it.
Do you think that was sort of the beginning of your path toward, you know, being involved with musical theater?
I absolutely believe that, yes. I was struck by that. I mean, I wanted to listen to it again the same day, and we didn't actually get to do that, but we got to listen to it again the next day.
Well, that's a perfect segue actually into what was my next question was I wanted to flesh out a little bit about, you know, Cypress Lake High, as I understand it, in the 80s really didn't have much in the way of music or, you know, theater even. And then all of a sudden it became a force of nature, which arcs all the way to now there's a Cypress Lake Center for the Arts.
Right.
And one of the first things I can remember seeing there was Jesus Christ Superstar. How did that all come about? You were an English teacher?
I was an English teacher. I was actually in drama class at Cypress when I was a student there.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't realize you were a student.
In the 70s. Sure,
oh, okay.
Sure.
That makes perfect sense.
And there was another legendary drama teacher there who I had the great fortune to learn from. And at that time, though, the school had no theater, no auditorium. Plays were done in the gymnasium.
Oh, like middle school style.
Exactly
sort of
like middle
days.
School. That's right. There was a very narrow stage with no wings, you know, one row of lights, no curtain. I mean, it was a hard place to do a play, but she did it. This is Jean Ball I'm talking about.
Okay.
And she did incredible productions, and that finished me off. You know, from that point on, I was going to be around stages.
And so what role did you play in the early days of, like, I guess they built a theater? Because when I remember going there in like 88, 89,
right,
there was
right.
an actual theater. You were in part of that.
That's
groundwork?
Exactly right. Yeah, they decided they were going to build an auditorium for the most of the high schools, the ones that didn't have one. Because it was just a necessity as the schools got larger. And so they built an auditorium at Cypress, and I volunteered to take over the drama classes. And they were more than happy. Well, step right up, because I had to give up the yearbook. Which I was doing in the early days. And then I said, well, okay, you'll be the drama teacher.
You know, I've gleaned from your Facebook posts and stuff that you really love the – you know, you mentioned in your bio stagecraft, you know, the being in the wings, being backstage, doing the lights, stuff like that.
Exactly.
How does that, you think, inform the way you connect to music and the way it affects people? Because part of that – is what people are hearing. And I think that kind of connects between what we're tapping into for this show and your experience as a person.
I think it probably really does inform how I listen to music. And it actually informs how I experience pretty much everything else. When I was a kid in high school, my father and my brother and I built a house by hand that we were going to live in. And from that moment on, I look at the architecture of things, how doors are constructed, how windows work. The same is for music. Once I realized, you know, when an orchestra has to set up, it's the chairs, it's the music stands, it's the light for the music stands, it's the extension cords for the lights for the music stand, it's the taps for the music stand, the sound mixing, the snakes, the everything you have to do in order for things to be heard. The same for movie making, for video production. All of the technical qualities of making art absolutely fascinate me. And I tried to infect other people with that, and I had a good time at that Cypress with the Stagecraft course.
You know, it's funny. I sometimes try to force myself to look at the world around me through that lens, like, you know, just the way curbs are constructed as you drive
exactly.
through downtown. Someone's looking
exactly.
at that and thinking, oh, that has such great – or you know what I mean? Like everything has context if you see it through
yes.
the right lens.
Absolutely.
What was the first music you owned yourself that you chose to purchase?
The first music I received was in response to a Christmas wish I had made, and I received records that I had heard about on the school bus or other places, and I got the soundtrack to 2001
to
the film,
okay.
right? Because I had to have that, and I got Alice Cooper's album Billion Dollar Babies.
Okay,
and I'm a kid. I don't know. I'm 12 or 13 or however old you are, and that's what I had asked for, and I was astonished that I got it, and thrilled, and didn't want to open any other presents. But yeah, that was the beginning of the record collection.
Okay, let's go to your first song choice then.
Okay.
And tell us what it is, and then you decide if you want to preface it with a story or have us listen to it, et cetera.
Well, it's quite a song that we're starting with the ELP, right? Is that
yes.
the first one?
Yes.
Okay. I discovered this at 4-H camp.
Okay.
And that's what you can imagine. It's a week of 4-H'ers in the summertime.
Gwen leaves Monday
you
for 4-H.
Oh, that's great. Okay. So, you know, and the kids are in cabins and so on. And I was what's called a senior in the 4-H program. When you get to be 13, they move you up and you take on some leadership responsibilities. And the leadership responsibility given to me, in addition to being a, you know, cabin counselor or whatever, was to do the wake up for everybody in the mornings.
Okay.
Right? And at Camp Cloverleaf.
That's where she's going,
which
man.
It's the best place. It's so great.
That's crazy.
So I love Camp Cloverleaf. So they have a little rec hall. They have a PA system inside so you can play records, and there's a microphone for, you know, announcements and skits and whatever. And you can switch at this time. This is in the early 70s. You could switch the PA system to the outside address system.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these big Cold War era
yeah, like
horns.
MASH.
Exactly. But they were enormous, you know. And so they're aimed out towards the cabins on each side, and they're big enough so that the throw reaches the adult cabins all the way down to the lakeside. And this is a good distance. This is like football field length.
Mm-hmm.
And so these are fun. This is a fun little toy, and I'm in charge of it.
Right.
And so the instruction is, so play reveille, play the bugle call, which is, I don't know, 15, 20 seconds, whatever. You do that, and then play some other song that you like, a soft rock or an R&B, something people will like and get them moving and get them up on time so we can start the day. Well, that's a great assignment. So I don't want to blow it. I play it safe. I only play music that I know everybody will like. So it's Seals and Crofts, or it's, you know, Bachman Turner Overdrive, or whatever we were listening to that I thought could pass muster. And nobody ever wanted to know in advance what it was going to be. Nobody ever screened it. Nobody ever scolded me or raised an eyebrow. It was just, hey, cool. Thanks, Jeff. And I'm like, this is me. This is what I'm here for. So I got to pick all that out. So this year, this is 74, I discover that in the back of the camp's record collection are all the albums left behind by the adult staff, who were mostly college students doing mm-hmm. a summer job. And they would have the weekends off. They would bring their own records. Sometimes they would leave them behind. So in the back of all of the camp songs and the children's songs and the, you know, whatever the equivalent was in those days, I find some adult records or some popular records that you wouldn't think of suitable for children. So there's some Black Sabbath. What does this sound like? So you put that on and you go, oh, gosh, they probably don't want me to play that. So what's this, Frank Zappa? Oh, no, that's probably not for everybody, so I'll just save that. And then there was this record, Brain Salad Surgery, right? And it's got this painting, which I later found out is by H.R. Giger, the guy that designed the Alien. From the Alien movies. And he was a fantastic painter and did all these macabre science fiction-y horror kind of things. But it's got this striking cover and it's called Brain Salad Surgery, which is a – I assume taken from a Dr. John song, which had that phrase in it. But I've never really understood what it means. But obviously this is a record that has to be dealt with. I have to put this on. The first song is a hymn. It's an old poem, a William Blake poem that they've set to music. And it's like, I don't know. This is not what I expected.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's a couple of other songs. There's kind of a popish song. There's a rowdy kind of bar song. And then there's this thing called Carn Evil Nine, which is in three impressions. And it's a science fiction-y horror story of – I don't know if it makes any sense, but it's like a, it's like a robot intelligence or an AI that takes over from the humans eventually.
Uh-huh.
And along the way, it describes kind of these images of cultural decay. So this is blowing my mind.
Yeah, this is 1974.
This is 1974. I'm 13 years old. You know, I know Seals and Crofts, right? This is the music I've been exposed to so far. I said, this is serious stuff. This is big time. So I put it in the back. I'm fine. I'll save that for later. So the night I discovered that, the adults all left the assembly that we were in. Most of them, a couple of them left the assembly we were in, went over to the cafeteria, and they were listening to a little transistor radio. I caught them doing that and asked what was going on. They were listening to the president.
Oh.
This is Nixon's resignation speech.
Okay.
I say, can I listen in? And they say, yeah, we think the president's going to resign. And I don't even really understand what a president was exactly.
I knew
he was the leader and all that. And I knew there was Watergate going on. I had been kind of fascinated by that process. I had watched some of the hearings but didn't understand what I was watching.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember this wild feeling and watching the faces of the adults, watching how seriously they were taking this because nobody knew what was coming next.
Right.
Right? And I could see they didn't know what the next day was going to be like. And so I'm listening to this and I'm just kind of flipping out. I'm a little kid getting a chance to sit in with the adults for what's obviously a historic moment. And when it was over, we all just went back over to the rec hall and, you know, played the Sweet records or the Bee Gees or whatever, you know. And it was just surreal. So the next morning, I'm feeling like, you know – things are coming a little unglued.
Yeah, the rules are uncertain.
So how about I play this song? How about I play this song I had found? Let's see what happens. So I play Carn Evil Nine.
Carn Evil Nine, First Impression, Part 2 from Emerson, Lake & Palmer's 1973 album Brain Salad Surgery. It's Jeff McCullough's first song on this episode of Three Song Stories.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start. Guaranteed to blow your head apart. We'll be right back.
So what was Camp Cloverleaf's first impression of that song? Get it?
That's perfect.
No, seriously, I'm trying to imagine that coming out of one of those old, like, surplus speakers and just all that getting cranked into that one big cone. And
it was one of the finest moments ever. It was just as great as you can imagine. And I was kind of thinking, well, we'll see what we get. You know, and you know what? I got a couple of, hey, what was that? But nobody said, are you nuts, or that was weird, or anything. It was just interest and curiosity. I thought, are you kidding? I got away with it. But listen to that music. Is that the 70s?
Oh, yeah.
All over the place?
Yeah.
I mean, this was really the first I had ever heard of progressive rock, at least at that extent. The length, the complexity, the use of synthesizers that in a way that's not just a novelty.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a beep, you know, or a cool space sound or something. There was a polyphonic synthesizer in there. I mean, he was playing chords, he was playing notes, there were synthetic drums in there too, which I had never heard.
Oh,
before.
Really?
Yeah. And there was the real, you know, the usual stuff, but it was just shocking to me that musicians could be so aggressive with something and get such an impressive result, something that sounded hard and rocking to me as my 13-year-old self. There's a lot to make fun of with progressive rock. Of course. I mean, there's the fog machines and the capes and all, you know, all of course. The ego, sure. But as far as adventure and being experimental and trying something different, it blew me away.
Hmm. What was the fourth song, or was there a fourth song that almost made it to your list? And also, if you could sort of deconstruct for me how you whittled. I want to know your process.
Well, I'm not sure about a fourth song. I had 21 I had narrowed it down to.
Okay.
And I believe I had asked you if we could squeeze 24 in. You declined and told me to do the work.
I said that's exactly what I said.
and so I did. Some of the ones I left out, there was a Patty Griffin song, Please Don't Let Me Die in Florida, which every Floridian should listen to. There was some Johnny Cash songs. There was a Springsteen song. We were talking before about the guy with the 24,000 CD collection.
Yeah, Tom
DeMarkey.
Know.
Right. I have that many songs in my head, I think, and they all speak to me.
How big is your collection? How is it collected, how do you listen to music these days?
I still have maybe 600 or 700 LPs. Which is about half of what I had at the peak. I gave a lot away to students.
Yeah. I could see you doing that, little infections.
Exactly. I at the time that started to get serious about collecting CDs, you know, there was this period of transition where I would buy some on LPs that I was serious about, and I would buy some on CDs if I needed it for convenience. Like mm-hmm. if I knew I was going to be playing it at a party or at a show or something, I would always get the CD because it was easier to deal with. And then eventually I stopped buying the LPs, and once I committed to that, I didn't feel a need to curate and collect them anymore. Mm-hmm. And I just let kids come over and say, yeah, take what you want. I'll get it on CD later. It went down by about half. But I still have them today.
Are you an audiophile? I mean, do you have like, you know, really nice speakers that you listen to them through, really nice headphones?
Oh yes.
That doesn't surprise me, yeah.
Oh yes. I'm pretty serious about that. And I caught that bug from some other people and it's never gone away.
What about like streaming stuff, Pandora and, you know, hey, Alexa, play me Emerson, Lake and Palmer?
I don't do any of that. My kids are all over that. They're experts at it and I'm just not. I do use my phone to listen to music in the car. That's about as
like you
as
have
hip
like,
as I can
you
get.
You have like you've converted CDs to music that's on your phone?
That's right.
Gotcha.
And I buy them digitally now. So, you know, it's all piled up in there.
Mixtapes. I normally ask, do you make mixtapes? I actually phrased it here. I have a feeling it would be silly to ask if you ever make mixtapes. So where did they fit? Seems like that would be so right up your alley.
Mixtapes were the best. I love getting them. I really love giving them. And I made hundreds of them. Sometimes, you know, in those days it was a lot of reasons you would do it. One, just to maybe to share with somebody, to introduce somebody something they were interested in. You'd like, hey, you like Jethro Tull? Here's the Jethro Tull's greatest,
yeah.
you know, deep cuts. These are the ones you really need to know.
Yeah.
So in the right sequence, and
you would
agonize over the right sequence. And then, of course, the other essential use of mixtapes is courtship. You know, it's to woo each other. And so I did plenty of that too. There's a real art to it, and I kind of miss that dimension of music. I suppose people can make playlists for each other now and maybe do. I don't know. I hope so.
Your kids haven't filled you in on whether that happens or not?
No. I don't. I really don't know.
Did you do the like the cover art and the, you know, you'd list all the songs on the back of the tape and everything, or was it pretty much just the tape?
With the runtime, yes, of course.
Of course.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yes. Very meticulous, very curated.
What was your first concert?
My first actual concert? It wasn't like just, you know, a band that happened to be at the fair, you know,
exactly,
something like that.
Yeah, no, we're talking rock and roll or, you know.
It was Uriah Heep and Kiss at the Hollywood Sportatorium.
Hollywood, Florida?
Hollywood, Florida Sportatorium. It was a big concrete box that was a wretched place to listen to music to. But I saw 100 concerts
there. Oh, yeah?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
What was the craziest concert experience you can recall?
Oh, the crazy – well, okay, that would be Tampa 1977, Led Zeppelin.
Ah.
They were the only act and – you know, we arrived bright and early. I think we got there about 9:30 in the morning at the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't let us in, so we spent the day, you know, bumping around record stores and music stores and playing synthesizers and getting chased out of different ones. Then went back to the stadium when they finally were going to let us in. Sat there blazing in the sun all day. It was raining on and off. It was kind of miserable. The band finally comes out. They play 4 songs and I'm – you know, this is my peak musical moment of my life. I'm seeing Led Zeppelin. I'm seeing the concert I've dreamed of seeing since I could imagine it. And then the rain just really lets loose and they have to quit. They have to say, we're going to take a break, but we'll be back. But everybody's like – nobody's in the mood for it at that point,
right.
You know, and I don't exactly know the sequence of things, but things went really bad really fast and they canceled the show and they chased everybody out and we had to go home wet, miserable and, you know, unfulfilled.
Do you remember which 4 songs you got to hear?
They weren't the ones I was there
yeah,
for.
They were building
you know,
up to
it
the,
was
yeah.
like, you know, the, you know, They might have played the rain song. I don't know. That would have been appropriate. But maybe Celebration Day, you know. They were warming up. Exactly. Yeah. We weren't into it. I didn't get my 25-minute dazed and confused.
Did you get like a rain check or anything back then? Or is that just
no,
like,
I regret so much that you could send in your stub, your ticket stub, and get a check back for your $10. You could get a refund. So I did that, and I got a check back from Led Zeppelin, and I didn't
cashed it.
I can't believe it. It's the great regret of my life, but I still have the ticket.
What's the furthest you ever traveled for a concert?
That's a good question. I don't think I've ever left the state, but I certainly drove from Estero to Jacksonville more than once. So what
that's
is that?
Yeah, that's six, seven hours.
That's a hike. Yeah, it's a day, right.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's move on to song number two.
All right. Song two is
it's Jackson Brown.
It's Jackson. Okay. All right. So a little story here. This is 1978. I'm a junior in high school. I'm 17 years old. This song comes out, and it's everything that I'm interested in, right? It's a song about roadies. It's about the backstage life. Mm-hmm. It's about setting up for the whole record, actually. The whole album is about life on the road. It's about what it's like to be on the tour bus, to be in the hotel room, to be backstage, to be on stage, you know, performing. It's a wonderful record. It's unlike anything else he ever did. And it's the only album of his that I ever fell in love with. And I did fall in love with this record. And this song it's two tied together. It's the Loadout and Stay, which is the old Maurice and the Zodiacs, you know, sing-along song that everybody loves. But the Loadout is kind of introspective. It passed for a deep song, you know, to me at the time because it was reflective that way. And I loved it. The next year, and I'm still working on the yearbook as a student in those days, we had this idea to sell yearbooks by having a slideshow of an assembly. And we would spend 2 weeks and take a picture of almost every kid in the school we could find, you know, just clowning around. We'd put them all on projectors and project them, and we'd put music behind them. And everybody went nuts because they'd see their friends, they'd see themselves, and they'd cheer, and yay, that makes you want to buy a yearbook. And it was fun. And so one of my best friends, one of my concert buddies, got the idea that he would do another slideshow for the end of the year just for the seniors. And it would be like the story of their 4 years in high school. And he did that, and he set it to music that was appropriate to that class. And I was really moved by it. So the next year comes around, and I get permission to do this for my senior class. So obviously I'm an Alice Cooper fan. There's going to be Schools Out. It's going to be in here. I put a bunch of other songs in here. But one of the key songs that people remember is The Loadout and Stay, which I put in there. And so many of the lyrics are about things that people do. Like there's a line about watching Richard Pryor videos. So I have a picture. So I sync that up in the slideshow with students going to a Richard Pryor movie. There's a movie poster behind them, right? And there's the band on the bus, and I have a picture of the high school marching band getting on the bus, you know, and I just do this with every line of the song, and you can just feel the room. You can feel them feeling like this song is really about us. It's a metaphor for this journey we've been on together and for saying goodbye to each other. And then when Stay comes around, you know, which is the second song, everybody starts crying and it's great. It's just wonderful, you know. Peak slideshow moment. So that's what the song means to me. I then use the song as a teacher later on, teaching other students how to make a slideshow for their class.
Yeah.
You know, here's how I lined it up. You can find a song that means the same for your class and line up line by line.
You know, my daughter in eighth grade, she's going to be the historian for the junior thespians, which means it's her job to put together the slideshow.
There you go.
I'm going to have her listen to this.
I love it.
All right, let's hear it. This is Jackson Brown, The Loadout and Stay from his 1977 album, Running on Empty. You're listening to Three Song Stories. It's biography through music.
Now the seats are all empty. Let the roadies take the stage. Pack it up and tear it down. They're the first to come and the last to leave. Working for that minimum wage. They'll set it up in another town. Tonight the people were so fine. They waited there in line. And when they got up on their feet, they made the show. And that was sweet. But I can hear the sound of slamming doors and folding chairs. And that's a sound they'll never know. Roll them cases out and lift them amps. And haul them trusses down and get them up them ramps. 'Cause when it comes to moving me, you know you guys are the champs. But when that last guitar's been packed away, you know that I still wanna play. So just make sure you got it all set to go before you come from my piano.
Scheduled to appear 1,000 miles.
will stay. Just a little bit longer. We won't play. Just a little bit longer. Now the promoter don't mind, and the union don't mind. If we take a little time and we leave it all behind and sing one more song.
You know, it occurs to me listening to that, A, yeah, knocked out of the park as far as, you know, a slideshow song.
Oh, yeah.
But B, because of the way music and memory works, I mean, some of your fellow classmates probably think about that slideshow when they hear those songs.
I hope so. You know? I certainly do.
I mean, because that's just how it works.
Right.
And that's
right.
It's
glued in. This song still is probably the most evocative of high school for me, just for that one day.
Yeah.
You know?
No, it's amazing. Did you ever consider a career as a roadie?
Yeah, sure I did.
Yeah,
it sounds pretty great.
What about just, you know, theater full-time instead of education?
I thought of that too.
Yeah?
But it's so much more fun to do theater with kids.
Yeah.
Then you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah. No, it's – you know, I was teleported back to about 2 weeks ago because the theater program at Dunbar that Gwen's a part of had their eighth grade send off, and they had a slideshow and those kids and they're all just blubbering and the teacher's blubbering. and I'm thinking, man, you know, it's just that's so cool.
It's the best.
I totally understand what you mean. Are there any TV theme songs that you can sing on demand? You don't have to do it, but you're a consumer of media, so
that I can sing on demand. I could probably, and won't do it, but probably could sing the All in the Family theme song. Yeah, because those lyrics were pretty hilarious
yeah,
and done ironically. So it really, and done live in the studio. They re-recorded it several times through the series.
Really?
Yeah, there are little differences each season.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fascinating. I had no idea. See, that's a little tidbits that we like to learn. Let's talk about technology and the way it's changed the way not only we access music, but I think there's a feedback loop in that the way we access music is changing the way bands make music.
Oh, sure.
Can you
connect
that? I think you would probably be good at reflecting upon that notion.
Wow. I like in the song we just listened to. There's some pretty heavy synthesizer work that's in there, but they had learned to detune and bend notes and make it sound more like an analog instrument, which adds a nice dimension to the song, but also really locks it into the late 70s. You know, you don't hear that now, not that way. What came after that, the early 80s synth era. You know, you can just hear it in your head. When you just hear the word, you can just imagine all that was. There was somebody did an analysis of, like, there was some year, 83, 84, where every single song that had hit the Billboard number one spot had prominent use of a synthesizer. That has almost faded now. Nobody thinks of synthesizers or not. They're either used or not used, but it's unremarkable. It's just another tool. Drum machines became that way for a long time. You know, the 808 thing was – it became how songs were written for 10 years or more, you know, because the technology enabled people to do things they could never do before, much easier than they could ever do before, and more immediately than they could ever do before. You didn't have to – you know, get 10 people to help you move a kit, you know, you could just sit at your desk and do it. I think that when I watch my children make music, and they're both musicians, my daughter put on an EP just this week.
Because of Facebook.
When I watch them work, it blows me away at how they can go from the creative impulse to saying, I want to sing or I want to make a music, to start making it in seconds. Mm-hmm. They just whip out their phone and they can actually start actually doing things. It isn't this elaborate kind of stagecrafty approach where you have to have a whole crew necessarily. Obviously, you still do that at a certain level, but you don't have to do that at the initial level. You can get an amazing result just by sitting around and thinking it up. It's a very exciting moment, I think, for musicians.
Do you think there's something lost along the way?
Well, sure. I worry that people forget how great a great guitar solo can be. You know, like David Lindley on the song we just listened to is a mad, insane guitar player, and he also did the second falsetto vocal, which cracks me up every time.
Cracked Richard Rich up too.
it's so hilarious. And you know, he's such a goofball. So I you know, sure, I worry that that some of those things get lost, but I'm not worried about it too much because I'm more hyped up over the democratic idea that more people can make music than ever before, and the immediacy of it. You know, you can have an idea and have a song on the internet in the same hour.
Yeah.
And if people do it all the time.
And if it has the right hook, it could go from 10 to 1,000 to 100,000 people in an hour too.
It's amazing.
Okay. Is there any band that you've recently discovered that our listeners might not hear? Or do you discover – how often do you discover new music?
I discover stuff all the time. Okay. My children teach me so much and then – you know, you just bump into things along the way. You know, if you haven't heard any, you know, Pakistani rap music, you need to.
I have not.
Because it's quite a scene and there's some amazing things going on. But the person I'm most struck by lately is Alan Stone, who apparently everybody knows about but me.
Not me.
You'll have a wonderful evening if you just dial that in. More roots, more Americana. He's a guitar player, does a lot of covers of classics.
My thing.
Oh my gosh, what a voice, what a sense of the guitar. You know, so if I was ever worried about, you know, losing the roots, this is the kind of kid that you know, he's not a kid anymore, but he's a young man, but he he gives me hope for that that tradition is all still there.
Is there a modern, mainstreamly popular band that you're a fan of? Like stuff that's right there in the face of culture?
I probably should have an answer to that. I'm not sure I do. I don't even
– You don't even know what's on that list.
I don't honestly even really know. I mean I suppose Kendrick, you know, is you know, obviously there's a major talent
right.
for sure. And but I don't think I can understand it the same way that the young people can understand it now. I'm always looking back on things, and he's in the moment now and he's speaking to them. So I can watch it and admire it, even though I don't think I feel it the same way they do. But I certainly admire it.
All right. Let's move on to song three.
Okay. Oh, right. And that's actually another throwback song. This is Muddy Waters. Okay. I came upon this one maybe a year after Jackson. This is my first year in college, University of Florida in Gainesville. And don't have a lot of money, but I discover that Gainesville has a used record store. And they will buy the albums that I don't want anymore. I can get store credit and pick up new ones. Well, I had a couple thousand records. So I'm like, I'm in business. You know, it's like a lending library.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just circulated.
You had all that credit to play with.
I circulated records in there like crazy. And one day I come across this one. It's came out in the late 70s. It's a Muddy Waters record. It's got a bunch of old classic blues players on it, but it was produced by Johnny Winter. So it has a pretty fresh, you know, modern recording sound to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really know Muddy Waters music. I said, this is a name I'm supposed to know, but I don't know a single song.
Yeah.
Right? So I take it back. I put it on, and I had a pretty decent stereo, at least by college standards of the day, I had a pretty nice stereo. And so I put it on, and halfway through the first song, I'm like, well, I have a new job. I have to find out everything I can about about Delta blues, about Chicago blues, about roots music, about, you know. And then the next day, I listen to this record, and I'm overwhelmed by the amount of love that's in it. You know, some of these are re-recorded songs, some are new songs. The players are just laying into it, but they're obviously having a lot of fun doing it. It doesn't have that constrained, meticulous feel, you know, like when something's – they've taken 10 years to make it. They just whip these songs off because they're that good and they had a ball, and it's – oh, I love it so much. So the next day, I harness the entire power of the University of Florida library system.
Uh-huh.
And I learn all about Lead Belly and Lightnin' Hopkins and Sun House and Muddy Waters and B.B. King, and I'm into Stax and Volt and Chess Records, and I'm like, ah. So it was – I got a master's degree in the blues immediately upon hearing this record.
Did that derail your educational process at all?
I don't want to talk about that, but it's what I learned is an important part of my education.
Okay. Well, let's hear it. This is Deep Down in Florida by Muddy Waters from the 1977 album Hard Again. I can't say 1977 today. You're listening to Three Song Stories.
Thank you. whistle. And sat down in the sand and played. To see an old friend of mine. Well, I believe I dropped down in Gainesville. Well, just to see an old buddy of mine. I'm gonna drop over in Newberry sometime. Well, all right, let's go back to Florida. Let's go back down to Florida where the sun shines.
Did you ever get to see Muddy Waters live?
I never did.
No?
It's a real heartbreak because he was definitely on the bucket list.
And you see any of those other blues greats while you had time?
I saw a few. Yeah. In fact, the day that Muddy Waters died, we saw Ray Charles, my wife and I.
Oh, really? Where?
In Virginia. That was a nice consolation there a little bit. But,
yeah.
But you know, that – man, this song, Muddy's my favorite, and this song might be one of my favorite Muddy songs. And I associate it obviously so much with the city of Gainesville.
Sure.
In fact, for years, all through college and all years after that, whenever I would come home and drive back to Gainesville, you'd have to use it as theme music. I would put the song on as I was pulling into Archer Road and driving back to campus. And that's the sound of arriving in Gainesville to me. And I did it for my children too when I first took them to Gainesville.
You know, I lived in Gainesville for about a year. And so I was in that with with you.
We'll go to Newberry sometime.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, no, living that with you. When was the last time you bought music that had a physical form?
An LP?
Or just, LP, CD, anything other than, an iTunes download or whatever it is you do.
The last LP we got was Peter Gabriel's So. I remember that. I remember being a little disappointed when I got home, thinking, I'm going to want to cart this around. So I wish I'd gotten the CD instead. And then the last CD I can remember getting was a Bob Marley massive compilation, 4-CD, beautifully
– kind of a greatest hits thing.
But a beautifully curated little collection, including some outtakes and alternate takes. And that – at the time, I had a big old conversion van that had a big CD changer in it. I put all 4 discs in and – didn't take them out for 2 years. it was Bob Marley all the time. And my kids grew up with that music and they still love it today. And it's just, man, talk about speaking to me. But that might have been my 4th song, a Bob Marley song.
Yeah. You ever see Bob Marley live?
No. I saw the Wailers
after
he died. Yeah. And that was a huge day for me. I was just walking on air, but obviously it was missing a very important part of the band.
Did you ever do any DJing either through like a record, like a radio studio or just, for crowd control reasons, like at a wedding or something?
Sure.
Music?
I was a DJ in high school. Started at 4-H camp, and DJing there in the first days consisted of playing one song on the one turntable.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call that DJing.
It's like, necessarily. Okay, everybody just hold still while I load the next record, and it kind of breaks the momentum. But I got a couple of turntables, some buddies of mine. We started doing dances and stuff in the summertime and I built a lighting kit to go with it. By hand, it was a real beast.
It's like a paying gig for you then? Was this like side work?
Well, it didn't cover my costs, but it was my hobby, sure.
Yeah.
I had some big, massive JBL cabinets that I carted around everywhere and had a flash pot. I mean, we were serious.
Okay.
We were
okay.
Serious about this. And did that all through high school.
Huh. We have a simpatico ness because I am the technical director for the Fort Myers Film Festival, which means I'm up in the booth. And so I'm the one who's controlling when the lights are doing
there
what, when the
go.
Mic's doing what,
the
what
best.
Songs are being played. And I love that behind the scenes ness too. So definitely on the same page there. What would be an album that you would choose if it was the only one you got to listen to forever?
I really hate that question.
That's tough.
That's so tough. Oh, the only one forever. It's okay. Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here. I can't not have that one. So that's got to be the answer.
Is there a song that you will always turn off if it comes on the radio while you're in the car, either A, for stylistic reasons or B, for like memory association reasons?
Well, that's a much better question. A song I always skip. I don't know. I don't. Maybe Inagata de Vida, just because I'm not in the mood for the ordeal. It's a great song, but you only need to do it so many times. And it's on my phone, so I do have to skip it every now and then.
But it's on your phone.
It's on my phone. But, it does have like a 6-minute drum solo in the middle, and you're just not always in the mood.
Is it true that in the early days of the internet, you had sort of an email group that you would talk to and solicit information from and compile information about? I heard this through a mutual friend.
Where did you hear that?
Well, from Mr. Chris.
That totally happened. Yes.
That's like Facebook before there was Facebook. You were like crafting social media. Like, I'm going to make this happen.
That is exactly what it was. It was a group of people, and I would send out like a set of questions or prompts, and I would collect everybody's responses.
And this would be like the 90s, right?
Oh, yeah. This is the 80s and 90s. And I would send it out anonymized, you know, so people knew that people in the group had made these responses, but they couldn't pick
track
exactly
it back to
which
who said
one.
What. Right.
So there was a little protection. And, oh, it was so much fun. It was hilarious.
I wish I could have been in on it.
Oh, it was hilarious. I lost a lot of those during a hard drive disaster, and I really miss it because there was some fun times.
How long have you been in administration?
A school district administrator?
Yeah. Or when did you leave teaching?
I left teaching in the late 90s, and I've been an administrator ever since.
Do you miss the classroom?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Every time I go back to a school, like we just finished commencement season, and it hits you every time. You know, you see the kids and you see the energy, and I of course I miss that. Those were the best days of my life. We're teaching.
Any final thoughts?
This is so much fun. I can't stand it, and I'm so glad you asked me to do this.
Well, I want to thank you very much. It's been a treat, absolutely. Jeff McCullers is the most interesting man in Estero, probably in Lee County and maybe even all of Southwest Florida. Jeff, thanks for sharing your memories.
Thank you so much.
We make this podcast in the WGCU studios on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Our show is co-created and produced by Richard Chin Kui. Our online content producers are Tara Callaghan and Anna Bejarano. Our executive producer is Chris Duffus. Our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Before our parting tune, I want to remind our listeners that we want to hear from you. What song takes you back directly to a memory and to a story? Once you've got one, just record the story onto your phone and send it to mysongstory@wgcu.org. We want to get our listener voices onto future episodes of this podcast. For my parting tune this week, I'm jumping back to the late 1980s at Cypress Lake High School. There was a benefit concert of some sort. One of the bands played a few Pink Floyd covers, which was for me my first introduction to the band, beyond maybe some early memories of hearing Another Brick in the Wall at the roller rink when I was far too young to know what on earth I was hearing. Well, I was blown away by this high school student rock band's performance and so started perking up my ears toward Pink Floyd, which until then would have been pretty far outside of my normal musical listening paradigm. So this is one of the songs I can definitely remember them playing. It's Comfortably Numb from Pink Floyd's renowned 1979 album, The Wall. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
There is no pain. Next time on Three Song Stories.
When they would do the fundraiser at WMNF, you know, this is when the phone lines used to light up and they'd say, don't light it up at home, light it up here. It took me back.